It all seemed so terribly familiar to Akmor when Te'alik led the way onto an exposed ledge, looking down the northwestern slopes of Firok Spoyer to the lower trails and ridges where they expected the running Wamas to be.
Your dagger.
Akmor didn't register that the Uskar Triath was addressing him, calling for his crystal dagger, thickly flecked with quartz. Akmor peered through the translucent blade, trying to use the magic to grant him distant sight.
I see. I don't.
Te'alig pulled the dagger from his hand.
You too.
He motioned to Agard and Akmor to go to the right, where a ridgeline formed a trail down the mountainside.
Down to the pines.
He pointed to a large line of tall pines some few hundred strides below.
With all speed, and curl back into the west. He had to go through there.
As those two started, Te'alig motioned to the other two to run down along a trail to the left, to the pines, and then curling back to the east to meet up with Akmor and Agard. Off they ran, and Te'alig brought the dagger up to his eyes and looked through the magical blade.
Meron.
He called to his wife and hoped that she still had the spiritual connection to him. Even though the witches had blessed their weapons this morning as soon as Akmor had alerted them of the traitor and the escaped slave, Te'alig knew that his power with the Farsight would be greatly enhanced if he could bring Meron back into his thoughts. She didn't answer his call. But it didn't matter a moment later, and the Uskar Triath grinned, for he spotted the Wamas stumbling along an open expanse of slippery rock straight down from his perch, just as he had expected. And he knew that his hunters, their feet lightened by the magic of the green flecks in their spear tips, would get to the pines before him. Te'alig would have the slave, surely. But that thought did not excite him. Before, he had wanted to torment this Wamas, mostly because of the obvious pain it caused to Aulin. But now he had Aulin too, and that was the most delicious thing of all.
Aulin will die, and then who might challenge me? Aulin will be forgotten before the snow has fully melted. I, with Meron beside me, will hold the Uskar in my grasp. What?
His smile became a mask of confusion then, as the ground beneath him trembled. As Firok Spoyer itself, it seemed, roared. He looked back to see a massive fireball rolling up into the morning sky.
Meron did that. I hope.
Agard led the way, eagerly running along the trail, his knuckles whitening with anticipation as he clutched his spear. For Akmor, it was quite the opposite.
What have I done?
Akmor's outrage had carried him from his cave to the Uskar encampment. Jealousy had driven him to betray Aulin and Badlan. Aulin, whom he desperately desired, and Badlan, who had kept him alive through the winter, selflessly. The slave could have killed him at any time, or could have simply refused to bring Akmor any food and let him starve to death. Now Badlan was doomed by Ogmore's witness, with Aulin condemned beside him.
He deserved it.
Akmor conjured that horrible image yet again, that he might hide behind his shock and anger. But he didn't believe his words. He would be long dead now except for the efforts of Badlan.
Keep up!
Agard circled back to him.
My leg!
It wasn't completely a lie. Going downhill was much tougher on his injured leg than crossing the side of the mountain, or even climbing.
I cannot kill him without incurring the wrath of Te'alik. You're to help in catching him.
Akmor just waved him along.
He's going to let you kill the Wamas. You have my envy.
What?
Te'alig will let you murder the Wamas. Might even let you be the first to torture Aulin before he finishes the witch. Might let us all have a turn with her.
Agard kept moving, and Akmor, stunned, somehow paced him. He didn't doubt Agard's claims. Te'alig was the cruelest man Akmor had ever known. He would force Akmor to kill Badlan precisely because he knew that doing so would bring great pain to Akmor. And Aulin. Could he doubt Agard's claims? Te'alig would likely have all the Uskar men take turns humiliating and raping her, as he, as the Uskar warriors all did when catching Wama's women on their raids. The image burned in Akmor's mind. He tried to cover it with the image of Aulin straddling Badlan, but he could not.
Badlan deserved it. Aulin deserved it.
He knew he was lying.
What have I done?
Ogmore's pace increased. He followed Agard around a shelf of boulders.
Agard, wait!
When the young warrior paused and turned to regard him, Akmor drove his spear into Agard's side, Eggard pulled away, the back edges of the crystalline spear tip tearing more of his flesh. He stumbled. Ogmor struck again, stabbing hard into Agard's hip, then retracted and slashed the spear across for the lurching Agard's face. Agard somehow ducked the attack. He tried to counter, but his torn hip would not comply, and he pitched forward, instinctively rolling to try to put some ground between him and his attacker. Ogmor, caught in confusion by his own impulsive actions, didn't pursue, but he didn't have to, for Agard's roll put him right to the edge of the other side of the trail, where the rocky shelf dropped away. He tried to catch himself, but again, his leg gave out under him, and over he tumbled. Ogmor ran to the ledge and saw the warrior crashing through the branches of some pines. He winced with the sound of every snapping branch and fought hard to breathe when Agard came out the bottom of the trees, falling in a broken lump to the hard ground below. Ogmor looked down the mountain trail toward the pines where he was supposed to set the trap for Botlan. He looked back up the other way, though Te'alig was not in sight.
What do I do now?
Te'alig would still catch Botlan, he knew without a doubt, and Aulin was already caught up the hill in the cave.
What?
Theric's Spoyer trembled, and Ogmor's eyes went wide as a massive fireball rose into the sky, higher up on the mountain, up by the secret cave, he knew. He moved back up the trail, ducking when he came in view of the rocky spur. Te'alig standing atop it and looking back up the mountain. He thought of going to Aulin. He thought of going to try to help Botlan run free. He thought of too much, and so, overwhelmed, Ogmor limped off to the southeast, trying to run from all of them. Clever woman. When she had enacted her serpentine shield before her tremendous fireball, Aulin had managed to keep it under her wrist bindings. And so the fireball had incinerated them, and Aulin freed her arms with an angry tug. Before the flames had fully died within the cave, Aulin was already rolling to her back, sitting up and going for the bindings around her ankles. But there she froze, for right beside her was the Uskar warrior who had clamped his foot down on her back, lying there on the floor, burning, flames coming out of his eye sockets. The young woman couldn't draw breath, and not for the acrid stench and smoke. Three men were down about her, charred beyond recognition. Her fireball had melted their skin and boiled their blood, killing them before they hit the ground. Aulin had killed three men. Three men who were acting in the way of the tribe, in the way it had always been. Now they were dead, by Aulin's hand, by her magic. She hadn't killed Meryn up at the Sacred Lee. She could have, after her initial burst of fiery wind. It would have been no big feat for her to strike again with a blast of lightning and finish the Uskar Regian. Certainly, if anyone was deserving of Aulin's wrath, it was Meryn, who had murdered Innova and tried to murder Aulin. But she hadn't done it, hadn't even thought of doing it. Aulin didn't want to kill anyone, didn't even want to kill animals except for the necessity of food, and even then, she hesitated. Now here she was in a cave with three mutilated, unrecognizable men dead around her by her hand, by her magic. She wanted to curl up and cry, but one thought had her moving, had her gathering the crystals she had collected from the witches and stumbling about the blasted cave.
Botlan!
He was out there running for his life, with Te'alig and the others in pursuit. He had no chance of getting off the mountain, not against the trained Uskar and their magic weapons, which would show them the way and lighten their feet that they could catch up to the fleeing slave. The makeshift satchel Aulin had used for the crystals was gone, so she gathered what was left of the rug on which she had been laying and tied up her treasure, then stumbled out of the cave, and was there amazed to see that her fireball had extended beyond the rocky confines and melted the snow many strides from the cave entrance, and had burned the branches of the small trees up above the cave as well. One tree was still burning. She had barely gone two running steps before her legs became those of the leopard, propelling her along with tremendous leaps, her falls mitigated by the green gemstone in her belly ring. She was a long way from the cave before she even took the moment to realize that Te'alig might be expecting her, for surely her blast had been seen all about this side of Theric's Spoyer. Meryn almost certainly knew that Aulin had survived her magical blast, and Meryn was Te'alig's wife, joined with him spiritually. Even without that, even if Meryn had not been able to regain contact after her expulsion from Aulin's mind, Te'alig had certainly seen the fireball. How could he not? She knew she should take care here, but she could not bring herself to slow her pace, not with Botlan in such danger. She was not surprised then, on one high leap from a ridgeline, to see movement below, a man angling for the area near where she would land. Owlin called upon her malachite and her moonstone, slowing her descent and turning it into a flight, moving to the side and easing herself down into a small copse of trees. As she landed, she saw that it was indeed Te'alik coming out from another tree line across the way. The images of the three charred bodies flashed in her mind, but she fought them away, for even that horror could not dissuade Owlin from this fight. Not against this one, a man most deserving of her wrath. He caught sight of her and charged. Owlin called to the graphite of her ankle, stomped her foot powerfully, and loosed a mighty stroke of lightning, blinding in its flash. When her vision returned, she saw that she had stopped Te'alik. He stood in the clearing between the two groups of trees, but he didn't appear hurt at all. Her bolt should have scorched him, should have at least taken control of his muscles and dropped him writhing to the ground. But he just stood there, grinning at her. Owlin stomped her foot again, sending a second, weaker lightning stroke, and this time, not blinded, Owlin saw it reach for the man, then simply stop before it got to him, dissipating into a flash of nothingness.
How can this be?
Te'alik lifted his spear to throw, and Owlin felt something then, the slightest tug on her belly ring. She didn't know what that might mean, but it occurred to her suddenly that the spear and the belly ring had formed an attachment, calling to each other. She ran to the side as Te'alik threw, and instinctively called upon her moonstone to put up a burst of wind against the missile to turn it aside. But that spear veered again, following her movement and flying for her belly. Slowed only slightly by the burst of wind, the spear came on. And only Owlin's leopard legs saved her, a single twitch throwing her high in the air at the very last instant. Even so, the spear tried to turn again and come up at her. But the magic in that crystalline weapon was not strong enough, and the energy of the throw had expired. Dagger drawn, Te'alik charged in behind the throw, and Owlin, descending from her leap, created a second burst of wind, this one full of flames, as she had done to Marin. But the magic went past him on either side and did not touch him, and did not slow him. The desperate witch landed with an emphatic stomp of her foot, calling to the blue stone of her anklet, and the ground before her flash froze into a field of ice, and this time, finally, Te'alik could not avoid the enchantment, his eyes going wide with surprise as he ran upon it. Skidding and sliding, he tumbled down hard, and Owlin sprang over him as he slid beneath her in a wide-limbed sprawl. She looked down as he passed under, and noted that his hand went to something at his waist. Flying away, Owlin didn't understand. But she felt a sharp pain then in her legs, the cracking of bone and the unexpected reversion to her full human form. She grabbed at the malachite to slow her descent, but so suddenly, could not hear the song. She crashed down and stumbled ahead on legs caught halfway between human and leopard. Her thoughts swirled.
I don't understand.
Something was protecting this warrior from her spells, something he could throw at her to steal the song of Uskar.
Is it Marin and the Coven?
She thought it must be them, in a spiritual joining with Te'alik, for she could not know about the powerful sunstone he carried, a gem that could defeat magic. Now she knew that she was in trouble, for she had no answers. She fell to the ground in the open area and forced herself back to her feet as her legs finally completed the transformation. She glanced back over her shoulder to see Te'alik going for his spear, the spear that could somehow hone in on her belly ring. Owlin was out of answers. Horrified, she just ran, trying to collect her wits and her breath. With every step, she replayed the fight, what had worked, what had not. With every step, she knew that she was running out of time. Talmadge groggily opened his eyes, noting the morning light peeking in through the seams of the tent they had given him and his two friends. It wasn't the morning light that had awakened him, though. He knew immediately. For outside, the village of Facet Cran was stirring. He sat up and shook the sleep from his mind, then glanced around to see Hote fast asleep and Adrian missing. Not disturbing his beloved, he slipped out of his bedroll, quietly grabbed his shirt, and put it on as he exited. Half the town was out there, all milling about the central clearing and all looking up to the south, to the imposing mountain.
I think you may wish to see this.
Thalmid shielded his eyes from the glare of the rising sun, limning the top snowy peaks of Ferox Spoyer.
A great fireball lifted into the morning sky. Something is going on up there.
She? Have they returned?
He had barely finished the question when a bright white lightning bolt flashed, not much more than halfway up the mountainside.
Uskar?
It must be!
Magic!
Daemon!
If it was indeed the magic using Uskar, they were far down from their mountain perch. A second bolt of lightning flashed. Talmadge winced, but instinctually understood. A flash of lightning, powerful and bright, without a cloud in the sky.
It's her,
perhaps.
Adrian held out his hand, palms up. Talmadge fished in his pockets, then dashed back into the tent and fell to the floor to shuffle through his bag.
What is wrong? Have the she come?
No. No.
Talmadge held up his crystal lens.
I just need it.
He rushed out of the tent without another word. He could use the lens himself and was sorely tempted to do so, but Adrian was more proficient. And besides, if he was right, he wasn't sure he wanted to see what Owlin was doing, or why she might be throwing lightning about the mountainside. He waited impatiently, tapping his foot and shifting constantly as the ranger put the lens up to his eye. Owlin stumbled, her fears putting her too far out ahead of her scrambling feet. She collected herself and dropped another patch of ice right behind her, hoping to slow the dangerous man. With every step, she expected his spear to catch up to her and skewer her. She crashed through some trees, grabbing the last of them to help her cut a fast turn to the side, then moved around one rock and down a narrow and bending trail between two others. She realized her mistake as soon as she rounded that bend, though, to find the trail spilling out to the top of a high rocky spur. She had to collect herself and find the Song of Uskar to find the malachite or the moonstone to get her off that jutting ledge. She ran to the end, hoping to see a way to climb down it. But no, it was a high prow of piled rocks, like so many others across Ferox Spoyer. A peninsula in the air, it ended at, and was flanked on both sides by a sheer drop.
Find yourself. Find your heart.
She closed her eyes. Owlin blinked open her dark eyes to see Tay Alec rounding the bend back at the narrow trail. But now she heard the song. She could leap away.
Or I can kill him and end this.
Instead of reaching for the malachite, she called upon two songs, those of the moonstone and the graphite. Owlin wove their notes together and waved her hands in circles above her head. And in moments, the sky above the spur darkened suddenly under a dark and swirling cloud, one flickering with energy. Te'alig skidded to a stop at the edge of the spur, looking up at her creation and grinning.
Clever girl!
Owlin brought down a bolt of lightning at him from the cloud above, and at the same time stomped her foot and covered the front half of the spur with ice. The lightning got right to Te'alig and then stopped, just stopped, the thunder of it echoing all about. Te'alig moved as if to throw his spear, but the cloud above was swirling, and it was obvious that no missile would get through that maelstrom.
Nowhere to run, foul witch!
He began easing forward. Owlin brought another lightning bolt down, and again it was defeated before it reached him. A third stroke came down to strike the ground right before him that shook the spur and jolted Te'alig, who stumbled on the ice-slickened surface. He stood upright.
You melted your own ice, fool!
He stepped forward more confidently. But his teeth chattered just a bit when he spoke, she noted. Her bolt had gotten through, at least a bit. Owlin understood the wear of magic and so now believed that Te'alig's use of his strange anti-magic was also tiring him.
One trick left to play.
She believed it would end this battle. She called to her malachite and ran toward Te'alig, then veered and leaped, calling down another lightning stroke to occupy his attention. She floated out wide of the spur, turning as she went to face it, and was surprised and hopeful to see that the lightning bolt, though again mostly defeated, had stung him this time.
Whatever magic he's using is beginning to fade.
She went to her moonstone with all her strength. Te'alig was on a slippery ledge. She meant to blow him off the other side. A simple gust of wind to end the fight. But her opponent reached his clenched fist out toward her and struck first. Some wave of discordant notes, some unknown anti-magic washing over Owlin, stealing her levitation as she focused on the moonstone. Down she plummeted. Talmadge hopped from foot to foot as Adrian slowly swiveled his head, peering through the magical lens. The flashes on the mountain had lessened, but there remained one storm cloud. It seemed to be a storm cloud, at least, though it was tiny and roiling and flickering with lightning.
I do not see the woman. Only a man. Atop a stony jag.
It had to be her. It might be still. Why am I down here?
Halfway up the mountain. A day's march. What might you have done?
Would have tried.
Tried to do what? This fight, if it was a fight.
He stopped and jumped back, startled, and lowered the lens.
Lightning.
A powerful bolt. From the cloud and at the man.
The rumble reached them, the ground trembling under the angry growl.
Not a day's march.
Hote rolled up beside Talmadge and took his hand.
Not for him.
She indicated Adrian.
There's nothing we, or he, could have done. Too far.
But you think it was her? This woman who saved you? Why?
I'm not for knowing. It's just a feeling.
No matter now. We've duty here, to our neighbors. The Shi await us at Karakhan Shoal. And so there we'll go to send them running. Can you see that place, Waterwalker?
Adrian, who was once more intently staring up the mountain through the crystal. He didn't seem to be looking in the same area as the thundercloud, though, and yet seemed even more on edge. Following Adrian's gaze, Talmadge, Catriona, and the others peered up the mountainside, shielding their eyes once more. They saw more flashes there, far afield of the first, and far from where that small storm cloud still flickered. Not lightning, though. These were flickers of light, like a mirror catching the rising sun and tinged in gold. All about the highest peaks of Ferox Spoyer came those flickers, to the right, the west, and to the east, far to the left. And from that direction where the morning sun shone more directly, there came responding flashes much lower down the mountainside. Without a word, Adrian sprinted out from the town, over to the side and the ridge that separated Facet Cran from Karakhan Shoal. The others followed, but the man, with his magic, went up the side of that ridge in long and sure strides, slowing not at all. At the top, he turned more to the east and went to the crystal again, his expression obviously grim. He only remained atop the rocks for a few heartbeats, then lowered the lens and leaped back down, floating the last few feet to land easily among the villagers. Before he even began to explain, the look on his face, one of sheer, open dread, spoke loudly.
What is it, my friend?
Catriona and the others crowded in.
We cannot go after the Uskar woman.
Karakhan Shoal!
But Adrian stared him in the eye and shook his head.
We cannot. You must ready the boats, with all haste.
The boats? What did you see?
They're coming.
Who?
Demons.
Demons?
Uskar?
No, not men. Demons.
How many?
Adrian stared. He turned back toward Karakhan Shoal, hidden behind the rocky ridge, then swept his gaze up the mountainside, all the way to the east, and now, all across Ferox Spoyer came the flickers of mirrors, golden mirrors, signaling.
How many?
All of them.
Panic gripped her, for she was too low to get her malachite or moonstone working in time to break her fall, and too high to accept the fall. She gripped the pendant on her hip, grabbing for the whetstone, thinking to heal as she landed. But in her desperation, the songs jumbled, and she gathered the power of the orange stone set atop the whetstone instead. It didn't matter, she knew. It didn't matter in her conscious thoughts that her hand on the pendant was no longer a hand, but was instead a leopard's paw. Owlin hardly took any of it in, hardly realized that her panic alone had elicited the power of her tattoo, and more fully than she had ever known. Not just her arms had transformed, but her legs as well. And on those hind legs, the legs of a cloud leopard, the drop was not so high. She landed hard, but not too hard, and dismissed her luck from her mind immediately, going with the energy of the gemstone cupped in her feline paw, bringing forth its power fully. High above her, she saw Te Ali hoist a rock over his head and heave it down at her.
Demon Fossa, what beast are you?
Owlin easily dodged and didn't allow the attack to distract her as she fell more fully into the orange stone. She saw Te'ale gather up another rock to throw, and she was glad. He should have been moving from the high outcropping of piled boulders, but then again, from his angle, he couldn't see the side of the spur glowing an angry red as the orange gemstone's power ate into them, exciting them, heating them. Te'ale's next missile barely missed, clipping off the ground near to Owlin. She called another lightning stroke from her conjured storm down upon him, and he jolted and clenched, and seemed to be barely holding his stance.
I'll have you, demon.
No.
Owlin shook her head and noted her handiwork with the orange stone, eyeing the piled boulders in those areas where the edges of the stones solidified the pile, edges now softening, even dripping in small bits where the stones had become molten. She looked back at Tay Alig, who began picking his way down, spear in hand. He had barely gone below the ledge, though, when he stopped and stared, mouth agape, at the angry orange glow of Owlin's magic.
What?
He turned to see Owlin below, looking up, her face locked in determination. She stamped her hind leg and threw a lightning bolt. Not at him, no, but at what she believed to be a critical joint in the outcropping pile. Immediately, the stones shifted and began to tumble. Again, luck alone saved Owlin, for she had not reverted her limbs to their human form, and the power of her leopard legs alone allowed her to leap away as the entire outcropping tumbled down. Boulders bouncing, magma splashing, huge rocks twisting and settling right where Owlin had been standing. Lost in the thunder of the rock slide were the screams of Tayali. Owlin heard them, though, in her mind, if not in her ears. She leaped back in after the stones and dust had settled to find the Uskar Triath wedged between two massive slabs of rock, only his upper body visible. Amazingly, he was still alive, still conscious.
Demon!
Blood flew with his spittle. She stared at him. In her mind, she saw, too, the charred bodies in the cave.
Is this to be my fourth kill of the day?
Save me, witch!
Tay Alig's entire aspect was changing. Likely, he had come to understand that he was dying here, and horribly.
The stones, they're crushing, bleeding!
Save you?
Owlin was certainly not enjoying this horrid moment.
As you would save me, or spare me, or spare Bodlon?
I will!
Tay Alig's groan became a violent and bloody cough. Owlin's hand, and it was a hand once more, as she dismissed the magic of the tattoo, went to her whetstone. She thought of the malachite and whether she'd be able to alleviate the weight enough to slip the broken man out of there.
Save me, witch! My wife!
My wife. Like Braith's wife. Owlin let go of the whetstone, called upon her tattoo, and raised her arm, her leopard paw, claws protracted. She showed mercy to this man, her tormentor. She took out his throat cleanly, one swipe, ending his pain forever. Ogmore stumbled aimlessly, not knowing where he should turn. From afar, he had heard the lightning, then the thunder of an avalanche, though he had moved too far to the west, down along a stone-filled dell, to see the incidents. He couldn't go back to the Uskar. He had killed Agard. He wanted to be with Owlin, to beg her forgiveness. But was she even still alive? Again, he wished that he could replay this terrible morning, wished that he had been less impulsive. Even the image of Bodlon beneath Owlin couldn't change his mind now. He had murdered Agard. Owlin was caught and likely dead. Bodlon was doomed. The man stumbled and continued along the trail, not even knowing where it might lead. His surprise was complete when she stepped onto the trail before him. His first thought was that she was an older woman, perhaps Marin's age, and that she was beautiful, whoever she was, whatever she was. For he had never seen such a being. He thought of Bodlon's story of the fight on the way. Was this the same creature? She took a step toward him. Ogmore lifted his spear, noting that she carried a flattened club of some dark green wood, with edges serrated by lines of what appeared to be actual teeth.
Tanchitok!
She motioned to the ground before Ogmore.
She wants me to kneel. To surrender.
Ogmore was in no mood for that. He leaped at her, stabbing his spear. How easily she dodged, the slightest of movements, but just enough so that the thrust went wide. And with her bat coming across to ensure that Ogmore couldn't sweep the weapon back in at her, the man retracted and leaped back. His opponent easily rolled her weapon hand to hand, spinning it over and over. A skilled warrior, Ogmore was not dazzled by the movements. No, he was instead looking for patterns, waiting for an opening. He saw it, and he struck. A thrust for her gut that could not miss. But it did miss, and badly. And from the side came the bat, swinging across, striking Ogmore's spear mid-shaft and cleanly breaking it. Before Ogmore could even react, before he could bring the remaining half of his spear in close to defend, the woman turned a sudden and perfect circuit, and suddenly her bat was up high, slashing down diagonally at the left side of his head. He fell back desperately, but felt the bite as the bat grazed him. He thought he had avoided any serious injury, until his blood began to spray up from the severed artery in his neck. Ogmore grabbed at the wound. He turned and started to run, but got whacked across the back of his legs and found himself on the ground.
No.
He began to crawl for all his life. He heard her walking calmly behind him.
No.
He felt a burst of hot pain across his back and could hardly believe the weight of the blow. Now his legs wouldn't answer his call, but he grabbed ahead with his hands, clawing, crawling, begging.
Eggard!
Ogmore saw the Uskar warrior hanging limply but alive, and in the grasp of two more strange-looking humanoids with painted faces. Ogmore didn't understand, was beyond comprehension, was too overwhelmed by this morning, all of it, all of his life's choices, seemed to speed past him then in this moment that was simply too terrifying to allow him to make sense of anything. The bat came down hard on Ogmore's head. A final explosion. An instant of bright white, burning light before eternal darkness. They came over the mountain ridges like a plague. 1,000 riders, tall and terrible on their lizard mounts. And behind them, the dark lines of huddled infantry, more numerous than could be counted. The whole mountain shook, and Lochbeag rippled with the impact of their march. Over at the boats of Facet Cran, the villagers and the refugees of Carrican Shoal looked back in shock, with many, led by Catriona, then reflexively grabbing for their weapons.
No, run! Sail out!
A line! Form a line!
To arms!
But off many ran, trying to form a defensive line akin to one that had earlier defeated the mountain goblins. Beside Adrian, Talmadge kissed Hotep, drew his sword, and started off. But before he had gone 2 strides, Adrian grabbed him by the shoulder and, with frightening strength, yanked him back, then kept pushing until he had pushed the man over the side and into the boat beside Hotep.
We cannot leave them.
But Adrian, strength enhanced by the magic of his armor, lifted the prow of that large boat, which was filled with more than a dozen villagers, and began driving his legs, pushing it out onto the lake. Adrian leaped over that prow as the boat floated free of the sands, hoisting yet another villager, a refugee from the neighboring town, over with him.
We can't leave them.
Talmadge moved for the rail. Again, Adrian grabbed him.
They have come to trust me and you. If we go back, many others will follow, and we'll die for nothing. We cannot win.
As if in answer to his prediction, the approaching lizard riders hoisted spears on strange Y-shaped handles. As one, they threw, snapping their arms forward, launching the missiles from the atlatls with frightening speed and accuracy. More than half of the 20 villagers rushing back to defend went down under that barrage. Many hit by more than one, more than 2 long spears, and with such force that they were thrown down hard to the ground. On came the strange-looking humanoids astride their green, golden-headed lizards. And those villagers who had not been hurt, or not hurt badly, turned back for the beach and ran for all their lives.
Row! Row! Sails up!
Sounds echoed across the water west and east, screams of fear and pain, and it quickly became clear that the other villages, too, were under attack. Adrian jumped out of the boat, calling upon his amber gem, running across the lake surface back toward shore, toward a boat that Catriona and some others were trying to launch. They got off the shore as another rain of missiles descended upon them, spearing several more.
Alive!
Catriona herself, a spear stabbing through her side, stumbled to the prow and threw a rope out toward the man. He turned and hunched it over his shoulder, then ran on, towing the craft. Back at the shore, more villagers died.
Thank you, Adrian.
On Catriona's boat, Relief was evident on the faces of the passengers, but looking back, Adrian's expression could not return any consolation. For the front ranks of the invading cavalry hit the beach and hardly slowed, the sleek lizards rushing into the water and gliding out with great speed.
We are doomed, all of us.
Cold and wet, Bodlon ran out of room. In a small clearing in the copse of pines, he saw the shadow of an Uskar warrior rushing before him, and when he turned, a second man came out from behind a tree. Crystal-tipped spear leveled his way.
Where will you run, Wamas?
From the trees to the right of the speaker came a living missile then, a feline form flying fast into the Uskar warrior, slamming against him before he could turn and bring his spear to bear, and tumbling with him into the trees the other way. Bodlon heard the growls, the screams of shock and terror. He wasn't about to wait around to learn the outcome, though, not with a second Uskar behind him. Off he ran, right past the tree where the first warrior had been, crashing through the limbs and stumbling on, out of the copse, and then again down the mountainside.
You there! Stop!
He heard that second Uskar shout out behind him, then screams of terror, accompanied by the leopard's growls. Down Bodlon ran, certain that he was being pursued once more by Uskar or by the Great Cat. He cut a sharp turn around a boulder, veering to his left along the descending trail, then skidded to a stop as something flew down in front of him, landing on the trail. For a moment, he was sure it was the leopard, but then it was not fully, at least.
Howlin?
She stood before him on shaky legs, trembling as they turned from those of a great cat to those of the young woman. Her face glowed with tattoos of a cat's face, mingling with her features, but then fading. And then it was just Owlin, standing on the trail, her clothing torn and ragged, barely covering her, her hands red with blood. Bodlon ran to her and hugged her, and checked those hands, only to realize that it wasn't her blood caked about her fingers and under her nails. He stepped back, staring at her wide-eyed. She held her hands up, and he pulled her in to hug her once more, crushing her close.
Tayalik is dead. I cannot go back. They'll not hear my words.
Where then? To Facet Cran?
Owlin nodded.
And fast. We must be fast away. Mirren hunts me.
Bodlon took her by the hand and started to move off. But Owlin tugged, resisting, and shook her head when he glanced back to regard her.
Too slow.
She pulled him in close to her side. The couple rose up from the ground as if on a pillow of air, and down the mountainside they floated, gaining speed. It was not long before they both realized that something was wrong across the mountainside, though. From their lofty vantage, the lake was spread before them, and its shores appeared wrong. The entire eastern and southern parts of the shore, those closest to their position, looked like a writhing mass of insects. Out on the water, Bodlon saw the ships, heading away from shore from several of the lakemen villages, and he noted the odd wakes trailing after them. Suddenly, the truth dawned on Bodlon. His eyes widened in shock.
Hold on more tightly.
Then a burst of wind came up from nowhere, it seemed, speeding them down the mountain. A pair of Mundanugu led the way, one helping Pixquakow, who was not skilled on a lizard mount, the other bearing the mirror, as Skathmizane had insisted. They clambered over the high ridge, scouts to either side guiding them, and down to the highest small plateau on the mountain, one that held a deep chasm. The high priest dismounted unsteadily and collected himself carefully before daring to approach the gorge. He waved to his escorts, who carried the mirror to him. Pixquakow closed his eyes. This was his most important task, his most sacred duty. He heard the whispers of Skathmizane. He positioned the Mundanugu accordingly and had them angle the mirror to the east to catch the reflection of the rising sun. Barely had the polished gold flashed with a brilliant and blinding catch of those beams than the mirror suddenly sparked and seemed to leap from the grasp of the two warriors, who helplessly flailed in trying to catch it as it pitched into the chasm. Panicked, one fell to the ground, grabbing, and the other seemed about to leap in after the sacred item.
At ease, you fools.
Both turned back to regard him as he stood there, nodding. and though his skull face couldn't smile, the pair surely noted the likeness of the augur behind that permanent mask.
This is as Skathmisane desired.
He motioned to the lizards.
You may go.
You will ride with us, High Priest.
Pixquiao shook his head, then walked around the chasm and climbed the northwestern ridge, the top of which afforded a grand view of the human tribe's mountain encampment. When he arrived at the top of the ridge, he peered over the stones. Pixquiao found that he could barely breathe. For in looking down, he saw the pines, a patch of eternal summer, and the nearly translucent giant orange crystal.
My glorious goal.
He prayed, and he watched. Climbing magically was one thing. Floating down to the ground on malachite magic was one thing. But speeding down the mountainside, the trees whirring past below, was something else altogether. Fortunately, Aulin had expected this. So when Badlan held on for all his life, crushing himself against Aulin's back as she worked the magic, she was able to maintain her concentration. She had to. As they neared the lower slopes, the couple saw clearly the swarm of enemies that had come against the lake towns. Thousands of strange-looking humanoids, tall and thin and with faces streaked red and blue, forehead to lips. Many rode lizards. Others lifted spears on throwing sticks and launched them at the flying witch. Aulin called upon her moonstone to create gusts of wind to deter those missiles, and then she climbed higher. At first, she figured to land outside one of the towns, hopefully the one named Facet Cran, that she and Badlan could go in to introduce themselves and possibly gain acceptance. Now, though, such a course was clearly impossible. These strange monsters held the towns, held all the land about the northwestern base of Firoxboyer, as far as Aulin could tell. The boats were their only hope, and to get to those boats, Aulin had to fly out over the water, and so over the lizards and their riders, which were swimming out after the flotilla. Aulin was desperately tired. Flying was a difficult and draining magic, going down the mountainside, but with Badlan on her back, even more so. She dismissed the negative thoughts and found her focus, sweeping down above Facet Cran, too fast for the spear throwers to react and let fly, then right out over the beach and above Loch Biug. It took the woman little time to recognize that the lizards would catch the boats, and so she eased her moonstone flight just a bit and sent her energies into the gray bar on her anklet. A bolt of lightning shot down from the witch to the water, there dispersing into a stunning ball of energy that crackled about the lead lizards. They faltered and slowed.
I'm sorry, Badlan.
Aulin weighed the good of the many in the boats over that of herself and Badlan. She understood what it would take to drive back the chasing swimmers, and knew that such magic would not allow her to find the strength to get the couple out to those fleeing craft. Another lightning bolt shot down. Aulin and Badlan dipped toward the lake, the witch catching them only at the last moment. Up she flew, up and away, her last burst of energy thrown into her moonstone and malachite. And as she rose, she threw another lightning bolt, and the leading lizards all faltered, and those behind began turning for the shore.
Hold me close.
He did, as the magic expired, that last burst of flight carrying them further out over the water to splash down hard into the cold lake. The song wouldn't come to them. Their dance became a jumbled mayhem of uncomplimentary movements and stumbles.
Ugh! Aulin!
Marin wrongly believed that the apostate was somehow still defeating them. Aulin had thrown them from her mind, unbelievably, and now was somehow interfering with the harmony of Uskar. From the Sacred Lee, the witches heard the rumbles of thunder down the mountain, the lightning explosions, and then, finally, the tremendous grumble of the avalanche as the rocky spur collapsed. Down Firoxboyer below the Uskar encampment, smoke and dust rose into the air.
She cannot be this powerful.
Sorsha held up her hands in surrender, giving up her dance altogether.
There is something else.
Cries from the encampment just north of them interrupted the old witch, Several moved as if meaning to go investigate, but Marin held them back.
Conabra!
She waved for that one alone to go investigate. Just returned from her fruitless spiritual searching, the younger witch held up her arms helplessly, her stare incredulous.
Just run!
The flustered woman sped off, disappearing into the jumble of small pines. Marin turned to the rest of them.
Dance! Dance! Find the song of Uskar in your hearts. Sing the song of Uskar with your lips. Deny the apostate.
They tried, forming their circle near the perimeter of Dale Uskar, and beginning again their slow-turning dance, beginning again their singing, which sounded horribly off-key.
Damn her, Uskar.
Marin moved right beside the crystal god, and even reached out to place her hand upon the physical manifestation of their divinity. As soon as her fingers touched the very warm obelisk, Marin understood her mistake. It was not Aulin. It could not be Aulin. For she felt a presence within that giant crystal such as she had never known before. Something mightier than she had ever imagined. Something foreign. Some new song so beautiful that it stole her breath and froze her thoughts upon its melody alone.
Uskar again?
Marin didn't hear. The witches stopped dancing and cautiously approached, but Marin didn't know it. All she knew was the power within the crystal, within the mountain. Something bright and glorious, something bubbling up from inside the heart of Firox Boyer. The ground beneath her feet began to shift and liquefy, but Marin didn't know it. All of Dale Uskar churned and melted, the 12 witches standing in the lee sinking suddenly to their waists in mud. But it wasn't until her fingers slipped from the side of the crystal that Marin even realized it. She came from her trance, hearing the cries of shock from her fellow witches, glancing about to see them all struggling to get to the edge, to the still solid ground near the pines. Marin, too, tried to wade through, but she felt the ground already hardening about her, hardening about them all.
What is this, Uskar again?
Aulin.
Marin had no other name to put to it. They were caught then, all of them, the ground firming about them as solidly as if it had never been disturbed, except that instead of thick grass carpeting the place, there were only 12 sprouts, the witches themselves, as if they were trees planted about the crystal.
Pray to Uskar! Sing!
There was no music. They floundered in the water, for neither really knew how to swim. Aulin tried to use her malachite to lift them, but Bodlon was terribly heavy, and the magic had worn too greatly on her. She needed time to simply rest and recover her thoughts and breath, but they had no time. On impulse, she called to the blue stone of her anklet, creating a sheet of ice, but directly below them. It shot up fast, gliding hard and causing more than a few bruises. But when it surfaced, a small ice floe had Aulin and her companions' heads above the water, at least. Not that it would do them any good unless she could find more magical strength, she realized. For the lead lizards and riders, too far back now perhaps to catch the boats, could surely catch these two.
Do something. I can't.
He didn't even know a word for swim. Aulin listened for the song, then looked about desperately for an answer. Turning to gauge the distance to the boats, she saw a man, stocky and muscled, and wearing a gleaming silver breastplate, running at her.
Who?
I do not know.
Running with long strides, obviously magically enhanced, the man cut the distance quickly and soon pulled up right beside the couple. He reached down and took Aulin's hand. And as soon as she grasped his fingers, she felt the magic that was keeping him atop the water, now gripping her and lifting her up as well. Aulin caught that magic, which was nowhere near as exhausting as her malachite or moonstone, and reached back to Bodlon, sharing it down the line. The three turned and ran. The nearest lizard riders tried to launch spears at them, but the attempts flew wildly and splashed down harmlessly. Soon after, the trio neared a boat. They noticed the lake man pointing.
Damned Uskar!
Uskar magic!
Another man came up between a pair of angry lake men, and his head was not elongated from rapping. And Aulin took heart, for this man, she recognized.
Talmadge!
Aulin!
No, she is Uskar!
She is a friend. She saved me.
More arguing ensued, and the trio cautiously slowed their approach.
Not him!
Aulin knew that Lakeman was speaking of Bodlon.
No, Uskar.
Talmadge seemed to be making little progress in this fight, with the dozen Lakemen and women on the boat arguing against him.
We have to help them!
His only support, a woman's voice from someone Aulin could not see.
He's not an Uskar. Talmadge, this is Bodlon of Fossa Kran, son of Innova, who was with child when the Uskar captured her.
The yelling on the boat stopped immediately, all of them crowding near the stern, trying to get a look.
Cal's son?
The older ones had known her. The younger ones knew her name.